From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Across the country, the number of COVID-19 cases has gone down slightly, and cities and states are now loosening some restrictions. In Oregon, for instance, gyms and movie theaters will be allowed to reopen with limited capacity starting tomorrow.
But while cases are down, we're seeing a record number of people dying. Just yesterday, more than 4,000 Americans died from COVID-19, and nearly 700 of them were here in California. With all of this in mind, Governor Gavin Newsom has gotten a lot of heat for his decision to lift stay-at-home orders for the state. Let's bring in Marisa Lagos, a political correspondent for KQED in San Francisco, for the latest. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yes. So, Marisa, we know that COVID-19 cases in California are going down, but it was just a few weeks ago that we were talking about some hospitals rationing care. How is Gavin Newsom defending his decision to lift restrictions?
I mean, he's essentially saying that there's light at the end of the tunnel. As you noted, I mean, those case rates have been going down. Hospitals are not out of the woods, but they're in a much better place. And I think the governor would not say this, but the sense among people I talked to is that he really was bowing to pressure because he was getting so much heat from all sides around this very strict statewide lockdown, you know, in a state of nearly 40 million people with 58 counties in some places that are not deep blue at all, that are not supporters of his.
Well, just to clarify, even though the strictest restrictions have been lifted, municipalities can actually choose to keep their own measures in place. So what does Newsom's order actually look like across the state?
It's going to vary from county to county, Tanya, but honestly, I mean, it's interesting to me. I think you're seeing the same type of pressure on officials, whether they be in very liberal San Francisco or such a diverse place like Los Angeles, both cities who have, you know, at times sort of erred even more conservative than the governor in terms of shutdowns, have said that they're going to reopen outdoor dining, for example, this week, allowing, you know, limited capacity, but like hair salons and some personal care services to move forward. So I think that, you know, what you see here is a really tenuous balance between the economic concerns of these small businesses and the health concerns that, of course, a lot of these city leaders still have. But I think that they, you know, in most areas of the state, we're going to see by the weekend a lot of those activities reopen.
I mean, there's so much conflict around this, as you said, businesses who are desperate to stay open up against the public health need. And Governor Newsom has already been in an unfavorable position. I mean, let's break it down for a minute. A few months ago, he gave the all clear to reopen bars. And then a month later, the state was hit with its second wave of infections. There were pictures of him going against protocol by having dinner with friends at a swanky restaurant. And then there's this vaccine distribution fallout and their budget problems as well. And then a recall effort, which a reporter asked him about at a press conference about lifting restrictions on Monday. Let's listen.
You know, the critics are saying this online, that this decision today comes amidst a recall campaign, comes amidst lawsuits, and they say that the timing on this is arbitrary and convenient based off of that. I want to give you a chance to respond to people that are saying that.
Yeah, that's just complete, utter nonsense. So let's just dispense with that fundamental, foundationally nonsense.
I mean, Marisa, is it nonsense? What's the latest on this effort to recall Governor Newsom?
Yeah, so the proponents need almost 1.5 million valid signatures by mid-March. They say they've collected 1.3 million, but those are raw signatures. They haven't been validated. Usually some get thrown out. But I would say there's an increasing concern in Democratic circles that this recall could qualify. You know, you mentioned vaccines. Schools are still closed in most communities. I think that if those two things change in the coming months, this will be a much less potent political effort. But I certainly know people around the governor are worried about the potential for a recall, which, if nothing else, will just suck attention into, you know, a special election.
And then there is the role of filling all of those vacant roles. Vice President Harris and Senator Alex Padilla both have appointments now. Of course, we know that Vice President is now the Vice President. And then we're looking at replacing Alex Padilla.
Yeah, so Padilla is his replacement, Shirley Weber, African-American woman from San Diego, is in the Senate this week getting confirmed. But the attorney general position will soon be vacant when Javier Becerra becomes Health and Human Services Secretary. So we'll see a lot of pressure on this governor.
Marisa Lagos is a political correspondent from KQED. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The oil and gas industry is pushing back against President Biden's pause on new oil and gas leases on federal land. The Western Energy Alliance has already filed a lawsuit against it. Kathleen Scamma is president of the group, which represents oil and gas companies in Western states. Kathleen, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
There are two Western states in particular that you represent where a lot of drilling happens on public land, New Mexico and Wyoming. So make the case. Why is this order bad for people in those states?
Well, those two states plus six other Western states that represent 97%+ of federal oil and natural gas production would have about $8 billion of a hole blown through their budgets by this order. That's $8 billion over the first Biden term. University of Wyoming professor estimates that about 58,700 jobs would be cut annually. So it's not insignificant, and it's certainly for states like Wyoming and New Mexico, which derive huge portions of their budgets from oil and natural gas development on federal lands, would be hard hit.
But is it really as bad or as urgent as you're saying? Most oil and gas drilling in the U.S. happens on private or state lands. And that's not going to change with this order. And also, many companies have already stockpiled drilling permits that are going to last for years.
Well, you know, it is true that the percentage of production in America from federal lands is about less than 10%. But, I mean, the Western states where we do develop oil and gas, like Wyoming, like New Mexico, Colorado, they will suffer job impacts and economic impacts. Now, I think President Biden was wise not to ban new permits on existing leases because that would have been an even larger economic impact. But still, the leasing ban, it does affect existing production.
Well, let's talk more about jobs and the economy, because you make the case that President Biden's plan would be a job killer. On the other hand, the president is saying that these changes will actually be very good for the economy and that they will also have the advantage of tackling climate change, which he called an existential threat to the planet. Let's listen.
When I think of climate change, I think of, and the answers to it, I think of jobs. A key plank of our Build Back Better recovery plan is building a modern, resilient climate infrastructure and clean energy future that will create millions of good-paying union jobs.
The president is also calling for the creation of a civilian climate corps initiative to put people to work, conserving and restoring land. What do you think about that? Did his focus on jobs yesterday at all comfort people in your industry?
Well, you know, we saw this at the start of the Obama administration when billions of dollars were used to subsidize wind and solar projects, many of which failed regardless. And there was all this talk about creating all these green jobs, and the Obama administration ended up classifying, you know, those who haul garbage and who work in consignment shops as green workers so that they could say that they had created green jobs. You know, it's not a matter of just killing oil and natural gas and then suddenly all these wind and solar jobs will be created. Now, the government may decide they want to continue subsidizing wind and solar and creating new jobs in that industry. But if you kill jobs in the oil and natural gas industry, people have to still drive their cars and heat their homes. And they need oil and natural gas to do that. Renewables don't do all that oil and natural gas do. Now, because this order is directed specifically at Western public lands, likely these jobs would just shift from the West to other parts of the country. But this notion that you can just create more jobs by killing jobs in the oil and natural gas industry, it's just not a direct line.
But isn't it true that a natural gas well in Wyoming could become a wind turbine job, for instance? And that is happening. I mean, solar and wind energy jobs have been growing and now outnumber coal and gas jobs in 30 different states.
Yes, they indeed have been growing, and those jobs are great. We support that. They may decide to subsidize more wind and solar jobs, but killing a natural gas job doesn't do that.
Let's not forget the bigger picture here. We're talking about the cost on the economy and local job markets. What about the cost on the planet, because extracting and burning oil and gas from public land generates, it's estimated, about 550 million tons of greenhouse gases. And the science is clear that we're heading down a dangerous path. What argument can your industry make for continuing the status quo?
Well, you know, we're not staying on the status quo. Natural gas is the number one reason the United States has reduced more greenhouse gas emissions than even wind and solar combined. We
still
do that because, but we still use it in the United States. So if we don't produce it here, where we have strict environmental regulations, where our industry continues to provide energy that reduces greenhouse gas emissions in the electricity sector, then we have to import it from somewhere else where they don't operate under those same strict environmental regulations.
Kathleen Scamma, president of the Western Energy Alliance, represents oil and gas companies in Western states. Kathleen, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Amazon employees in Alabama could soon be the first union of Amazon warehouse workers in the United States. And according to organizers, more than half of the employees in that warehouse have already indicated they want a union shop. The National Labor Relations Board set up a union election after hearing from those workers over the summer. Amazon has historically resisted calls for unions. At least two past attempts at the company have failed. But organizers think this time may be different. Stuart Applebaum is president of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, the union these warehouse workers hope to join. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you today.
Yes, thank you for being here. Your union was contacted by a group of workers at this Amazon warehouse, which is in Bessemer, Alabama, right outside of Birmingham. This warehouse is not even a year old. What prompted this vote to unionize so quickly?
I believe the workers at the facility in Bessemer, Alabama, were experiencing what Amazon workers all over the world have been experiencing. And that has been a disrespect for them as workers, as people who make Amazon profitable. They want to know that their health and safety is going to be respected, that they're going to be treated as human beings. Every motion is being monitored that they make. Every time they raise their hand, it's monitored. I think they want to know that if they have a problem with their employer, they're not going to be in there alone, that they're going to have support. They'll know that they are not at-will employees if there's a union contract. And most of all, they want safer working conditions. The company seems to be more concerned about the robots in the facility than they are about the human beings that are employed there.
This is the first large union election for Amazon. But about 6 years ago, a small number of technicians at a warehouse in Delaware voted against unionizing. Another union drive actually happened 21 years ago in Seattle, and that one also failed by a wide margin. Why do you think things are different this time around, especially in a right-to-work state like Alabama?
I believe that the pandemic opened a lot of people's eyes. They understand now better than they ever did before that they need a collective voice to stand up for themselves and to protect themselves. Amazon has been doing heat charts to see where they would expect potential union organizing to take place. I don't think they ever expected that it would be in Alabama. But I think that the reason it's there is because Bessemer has a history of being a strong union town. Decades ago, it's where the steel mills were located. People could speak to their parents or grandparents and hear about the difference unions made in their lives. I also think that the facility was new, and I think people had expectations when they came in that were not being realized. And so I think people understand with Amazon's wealth that it can be doing better than it is.
You mentioned there are 6,000 workers at this fulfillment center. There are also seasonal employees there. I just want to know what difficulties you've had in helping them organize. What do you see as the biggest challenge right now?
People are afraid of Amazon. even if Amazon says it's not pressuring people, it's creating the impression that people should be afraid. That is why people often don't want to be seen coming to meetings. That's why people often don't want their names used. They expect that there would be retaliation. The company has said, is telling people, if the union comes, it's going to cost you a lot of money. Even though they know that Alabama is a right-to-work state, and nobody has to pay dues if they don't want to.
Amazon has started counter-organizing. They're basically arguing that union dues would cost employees too much and wouldn't guarantee higher wages or better benefits. What kind of counter-organizing have you seen from Amazon? And basically, how are your local organizers responding to it?
We are seeing a typical anti-union campaign from Amazon. They've hired a law firm that's known for union busting. Amazon has brought in a lot of people to walk through the facility and to talk to workers and to tell them that Amazon deserves a second chance. We want to know what you're thinking. We want to do better. Something that they are not doing at any of their other facilities, and something that they clearly should have done long before. They have signs up throughout the facility discouraging them from signing cards or speaking to union organizers. They have created videos telling people, telling their managers how to stifle any union activity. Regardless of what they're saying about not pressuring people, the facts are different.
Many of the employees at this warehouse are Black, and we're reading that union organizers are actually building their campaign around Black Lives Matter. What role is race playing in this union drive?
We see this campaign to be as much of a civil rights struggle as it is a labor struggle. It's time for these workers to be treated with respect. We see this as both a labor struggle and as a civil rights struggle, which has often been the story of the labor movement in the South. We have a proud tradition of being involved in the civil rights movement, and we see the effort at this warehouse as being a continuation of that.
That's Stuart Applebaum, president of the Retail Wholesale and Department Store Union. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, as Congress debates whether to issue a third round of stimulus checks to millions of Americans in need, a few of you have asked over the months, what should we do if we don't need the money? Well, there's one guy in Oregon with an answer.
My name is Alan Schaffler. I'm a news anchor and storyteller for Central Oregon Daily News in Bend, Oregon, right about in the center of the state.
A few weeks ago, Alan Schaffler noticed a bump in his bank account, $1,200 from the federal government.
You know, it just didn't feel right. I was driving home from work and thinking about it, and it just didn't feel right. I just don't need that money right now. And you look around the community, you know, almost any community right now, and you see people who are in, you know, dire need, who need help now. And so I tried to figure out a way to make that money, to get that money where it matters.
So Schaffler sat down and wrote a pitch to the people of Central Oregon.
We don't need the money. You know, we have a house, we have food. So if you're in a position to consider it, we'd ask you to think about redirecting the check. And so, and I branded it as redirect the check. And I just sent that to my news director and to my general manager and just said, I'd like to do something with this. Can we do something with this? And they bought in immediately. And that's it, the response has just been fantastic, just really, really gratifying.
With a match from his workplace, Redirect the Check has raised more than $50,000. And that money is going directly to nonprofits.
They all offer quite a few different kinds of services. The food bank isn't just a food bank. They do counseling. They help with rent relief and all kinds of things. And, you know, the shelter also provides a range of different services. And the Veterans Outreach Organization, which is tremendous, just helps local vets in a lot of different ways.
Rachel Hawkinson with the local food bank Neighbor Impact says this donation comes right on time.
We expect to use those funds to help us expand the food bank, which is definitely a need for us here at the food bank, where even before the pandemic, when we were distributing half the food that we are now, we were already distributing and processing more food per square foot than any other food program in the state.
The Redirect the Check campaign ends in Central Oregon on Friday, but with Congress considering a third round of stimulus checks, Schaffler wants to see this spirit of giving spread throughout the country.
If you've gotten $600 that the government has just dropped in your pocket, you know, why not go support your local ceramic artists? Go buy $600 worth of art that you've always wanted and could never afford. Go to your local favorite bar and restaurant and give them $600 cash and just say, start me a tab. And when we can dine indoors again, you know, I'll work it off. I bet they'll take your money now and serve you food later. It feels really good. It really does. So many people just want an opportunity to give. And if you make it easy for them, they'll do it. And frankly, I think there are a lot of people around the country who sort of fit my profile. You know, we fit in the definitions that the government set aside for people who get this money, but we just don't need the money. There are other people who just need it much, much more.
Alan Schaffler, anchor and storyteller with Central Oregon News, who started Redirect the Check for those in Central Oregon who want to donate their stimulus checks to those in need.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
We are still in the middle of this pandemic, and right now, having science news you can trust, from variants to vaccines, is essential. NPR Shortwave has your back. About 10 minutes every weekday, listen and subscribe to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
At least 429,000 people in the U.S. have died from COVID-19, but we're also in peak flu season, and health experts had been worried about a potential twindemic of flu and COVID. Joining us on Skype is Dr. Emily Landon, the Executive Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Medicine. Dr. Landon, welcome. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
So all the reports that we're seeing show that the number of flu cases is actually pretty low compared to previous years. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing exactly the same thing. At the University of Chicago, we just registered our third flu case of the entire year, the entire season.
Wow.
Usually what? At this time of year, we have over 100 each week.
Okay, that is so interesting. And I guess the question is, why? Is it the strain itself, or is it because we're all taking extra precautions?
It's because we're wearing masks, keeping distance, and cutting back on our contacts. These things have been known for eons to prevent the spread of influenza and other respiratory viruses. And unfortunately, that should give us a real reality check about how incredibly contagious COVID is compared to these other respiratory viruses. We're not seeing influenza. We're not seeing RSV, which some parents will know is sort of a scourge in children at this time of year every year. It's pretty amazing how incredibly successful these steps that we've taken to prevent COVID have been in suppressing all these other respiratory viruses.
Well, it is such a nice spot of bright news here on a very difficult news cycle. So is it safe to say that these fears of a twindemic, both flu and COVID-19 going at the same time out of control, that they have passed?
I think that influenza and COVID really can't coexist at the same time if we're doing things to try and prevent them from happening. You know, every year, 30 to 80,000 Americans die of influenza, and none of them, well, maybe not none of them, but That's not going to happen this year. We're going to lose a lot of people to COVID, but we can learn a lot from this in order to help prevent flu in the future.
But you know what I'm thinking? Like, COVID-19 is spreading out of control, so apparently we're not being that careful. Does it tell you something about the different way that these two viruses spread?
Yeah, COVID is incredibly more transmissible, and people are more susceptible to COVID than they are to influenza. And so between the transmissibility and the fact that COVID is still pretty new to our immune systems, I think we can see how impressively COVID spreads in populations.
There were spot shortages of the flu vaccine last fall. Are you seeing any problems with vaccine supply right now?
No, we're doing fine. There's still flu vaccine available. And I do think it's worthwhile to get your flu shot. So as we vaccinate people for COVID-19 and people are going to begin to be able to get out and spend more time together, that does increase the risk of a flu resurgence in the spring. We've seen it before with other flu strains that sort of stick around and they sort of circulate below our threshold of an epidemic. But then once people have more contact with one another, they're able to spread more. So if we do get everybody vaccinated and people start going back to their normal activities, then we're going to see flu come back. So there's still time to get your flu shot now if you haven't already done so.
Dr. Emily Landon, Executive Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Medicine. 3 cases of the flu at your hospital. It's late January. That is amazing. Dr. Landon, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
A terror advisory bulletin from the Department of Homeland Security is warning of a heightened threat across the country from ideologically motivated violent extremists. DHS rarely sends out these warnings, but officials say they've received information that these people object to the exercise of government authority and the presidential transition. And this comes more than 3 weeks after that violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. We're joined now by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie with the latest on this. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Tanya.
Tell us more about this bulletin. What kind of threats is the department looking into?
Well, the bulletin doesn't name any individual or any group or any specific threat. It's a very generalized warning about the far right and this expectation that there is an elevated threat level for at least the next few months. The statement cites the U.S. presidential election in November, the January 6th assault on the Capitol, and even last week's presidential transition. Now, it makes the point that we shouldn't just see this as one concentrated period of, over the past couple months where tensions were inflamed and events got out of hand, but rather there's this concern that in Washington and across the country, we should view this as an ongoing risk.
I know that you said we don't have much information. This warning describes these ideologically motivated violent extremists as having, quote, perceived grievances fueled by false narratives. Do you have any idea who these people are and what you might have learned about their motivations?
Well, obviously, this reference to false narrative is clearly talking about former President Trump and his supporters who claim he won the election. And as we saw in the Capitol, at the Capitol a few weeks ago, it's this range of individuals and groups on the far right, white supremacists, anti-government folks, those who talk about a deep state. And we should just remind listeners, we're now up to about 150 arrests from that particular event, and hundreds of cases are under investigation. And as these individuals and groups continue their chatter on social media, they clearly know they're being watched and that this may be a good time for them to be cautious and stay below the radar.
Okay. As I mentioned, the DHS does not put out many of these bulletins. Why is it doing it now, and what are they asking for from the general public?
Right. They've only done this once in the past year, and that was when there was tensions with Iran a year ago. And we haven't seen the government issue this kind of broad general warning about the far right ever from DHS. So by doing so very publicly, the Biden administration seems to be sending a message on several levels. It's telling law enforcement this is going to be a priority. It's telling the far-right groups they're going to be closely watched. And it's also signaling to the public that these cases will be aggressively pursued, much more so than during the Trump administration.
Right. It appears to be a broader effort by the Biden administration to address this threat That's NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. As always, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Illinois is on the verge of becoming the first state to abolish cash bail after lawmakers passed an ambitious slate of criminal justice reforms earlier this month. Supporters say ending cash bail will help end the criminalization of poverty, specifically the practice of jailing people accused of nonviolent crimes until their trial. Prosecutors and police say it will put public safety at risk. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul joins us now. He's on a Skype line. He's also a Democrat. And Kwame, this is a major reform. It would be the first of its kind for a state once the governor signs it. Tell me why you support it.
It was amongst a group of reforms that we were addressing to get our state law to be just to people who are assumed innocent until proven guilty. And so in Cook County, which is our biggest county, the Cook County Jail has had a history of being overpopulated. And part of the reason is people simply could not afford the bond that would be set. And our system should not be formulated in a way that holds people simply because they can't afford the bond set. It should be based on risks to the public safety.
And we will talk about those details in just a moment. But for people who aren't familiar with the criminal justice system, can you walk us through a typical scenario? You know, what would someone waiting in jail have to pay in order to get out? And why is that such a challenge for some people?
Well, it varies. But even the smallest bond, the smallest might be $100, might be prohibitive for some people. So you can have somebody who's got easy access to cash because they're a major drug dealer or something, but they may be a very serious risk to the public safety, yet they can post bond. Meanwhile, you can have somebody who might be in on a minor retail theft who can't afford $100, and they're held historically longer than they would be sentenced for the offense that they were charged with.
Well, as you know, you're going to have critics here. First of all, one of the big concerns that prosecutors and law enforcement have is that people who should not be out on the streets will now be let go, and then they may not show up for court. How do you address that?
Well, the bill, the proposed law, has characteristics within it that require a judge to consider the nature and circumstances of the offense, the weight of the evidence against the defendant. You know, a judge can hold somebody based on those, identifiable risks.
I mentioned that some police are concerned here. The law is going to make it easier to discipline police officers. It would allow for anonymous complaints against them and would also require every Illinois cop to wear a body camera by 2025. And I want to play this tape from Ed Wojcicki, who is at the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police, speaking to NBC5 Chicago.
Our jobs are now more difficult. They're going to let more criminals run free and they're going to make it more difficult for us to apprehend criminals.
Your response to that? I mean, is there a way to get police officers on board with this law, or are you just running the risk here of alienating them?
Well, the law is comprehensive and there are a lot of components to it. One of the components that I worked with along with Ed and the police chiefs and the sheriffs is having a more robust police decertification system within the state of Illinois. Prior to now, you can only decertify a police officer if they were convicted of a felony or certain sex-related and serious misdemeanors. Now we provide more discretion, because what we want to do is we want to rebuild trust in law enforcement, and we want to get rid of police officers who ought not be police officers. And that shouldn't be something that anybody complains about, because we ought not have a system that retains people that might repeatedly use excessive use of force and do the types of things that the nation has seen by way of body cam video, or in the one case in Minnesota, the video of a 17-year-old girl who just happened to be on the scene while a knee was put to the neck of an individual until they died.
I certainly hear your point. It does, though, sound like law enforcement is not on board with this law. It's not going to go into effect for a couple of years until January 2023. Are you open to changes that would accommodate some of their criticisms?
Yeah, so I came to the Office of Attorney General by way of having served in the General Assembly in the Illinois State Senate for 14 years. And so what I do know, when we do something that's as comprehensive as this omnibus bill, there are going to be some language changes, some cleanup that might be needed. And so there's already talk about doing a trailer bill to clean up, you know, whatever some of those things may be. It's important to note that in any jurisdiction, when you do something major that is as comprehensive as the bill that was just passed in Illinois, it's always controversial at the time. You know, change is controversial. Reform is controversial because people are so accustomed to the status quo. But the status quo has sold us short.
Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul, a Democrat, thank you very much for your time.
I appreciate it.
No one will be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame this year. None of the candidates reached the voting threshold to pass, and the person who came closest, pitcher Curt Schilling, has now requested to be removed from the ballot next year. And for more, let's bring in Mike Pesca. He's Here and Now sports analyst. He also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
So it is not unheard of for there not to be a Hall of Fame class, but it's extremely rare. What happened this year?
Yeah, it is extremely rare, and it's maybe unheard of when you have players of the quality as players some of the rejected players were. So a second and third on the list, and you mentioned Schilling, a special case, we'll get to him. Second and third getting about 61% of the vote each, and you need 75% of the vote of the sports writers to get into the hall, are Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens. Barry Bonds, arguably the greatest offensive player of all time, and that includes Babe Ruth and Hank Aaron, and Roger Clemens, to my mind, the best pitcher of the last 35 years. Wait, why aren't they in the Hall of Fame? The answer is, of course, when you hear their names, I'm sure many of the listeners said, oh, well, PEDs. They both took, admitted to taking, you know, Bond says he didn't know, Clemens, it's pretty clear that he took performance-enhancing drugs. And this is a disqualifier, although it's not extremely consistent, because there are certainly members of the Hall of Fame who took performance-enhancing drugs. Mm-hmm. And next year, David Ortiz will be on the ballot, and there are very credible reports at some points in his career he took performance-enhancing drugs. So it's a little bit of a morass and a mishmash about who gets in and who doesn't and who gets punished. And it's a confusing, and I think to the world of baseball, dispiriting situation.
Yeah, I want to talk to you more about that mishmash. But let's talk a little bit about Curt Schilling. So he was just a few votes shy of making it this year, but there's now this huge backlash. Why is he so controversial?
So his resume would argue for inclusion in the hall. He's one of the best postseason pitchers of all time. You know, not one of the greatest pitchers. He's not maybe in the upper echelon of Hall of Fame members, but he deserves inclusion based on what he did on the field. What he did, as a player, he was always seen as brash and outspoken, and a lot of people didn't like him, but it's what he has done and said afterwards. In 2016, he was fired by ESPN for pretty vicious anti-trans comments. He has since become a QAnon adherent. He is not just a huge Trump supporter, but he's very vocal about it. He perpetuates propaganda. On January 6th, the date of the insurrection, he was cheering on people who were in the crowd and protesting the discredited stolen vote theory. So that's who he is. And Hall of Fame voters, human beings who are baseball writers, have said, I just will not vote for this guy based on who he's become, what he represents, and also the fact that there is a clause in inclusion, the very clause that precludes Bonds and Clemens from getting in, called the character clause, about character and integrity. They don't think right. Curt Schilling lives up to that clause.
Okay, let's talk more, though, about that clause. I mean, some critics are saying that this whole process just shows how the Hall of Fame's voting system is broken, because not only is it about performance, but it's about their personal lives, too. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, well, and also I mentioned that baseball writers are the ones who vote, and it's a tough situation for them. In fact, an impossible situation for many, and more prominent baseball writers are saying, I don't want any part of this. You've given me an impossible task. I have to render a judgment on the goodness of people, not just the goodness of players, and take into account that the character clause, character and integrity, was written when the Hall of Fame started in the 30s and written down on paper as the character clause in the 40s, a time when African Americans could not play baseball. So the definition of character was beholden or upholding a system that literally precluded African Americans from participating in it. That's character. That's the morale. It was written, the character clause was written by Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the first commissioner of baseball, who kept Jackie Robinson out of the major leagues. So there is so much, it's such a tough position for the voters to be in, and it's very hard to define what makes a Hall of Famer, given that we have this collision of the morality of 70 to 90 years ago to the morality of today. And this is why a lot of the writers are saying, leave me out of this.
Okay, so Mike, is there an appetite for looking at Hall of Fame rules and reassessing them?
Yeah, one suggestion I've seen from writers is, you guys at the Hall, clear the people in terms of character. Take that off the table for me. But of course, the Hall of Fame doesn't want to do that. The Hall of Fame doesn't want to render judgment on character. And another idea is, let us not have this voting. If you are very good, we'll act like a museum. Sometimes you put problematic artists in a museum, but you have a little plaque explaining who they were. Maybe it should just be more about the history of baseball rather than baseball conferring an honor upon you. But there are, you know, hundreds of people who deserve the honor. It would be a shame if, when someone of fine character and excellent ability isn't allowed to be in the Hall of Fame or isn't allowed to be in the same way that his forebearers were.
I only have like 15 or 20 seconds with you. I just want to bring up with you, NBA reporter Sekou Smith died of COVID-19. Such an influential person in the NBA journalism community. What are you going to miss most about him?
I listen to so many NBA podcasts, and he's still on them. From mid-January, I was going through and listening to Sekou, and then 2 weeks later, 48 years old, he died. Oh, it's so sad.
Major loss. Such a major loss. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. As always, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.